Hello and welcome to the Right to Sustainable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the referendum in 2016.
Hello, and I'm Jazza, and I am a, quote, basic bitch with predictable opinions, end quote.
I voted Remain. Who could have said something like that?
Who would have said something like that, Jimmy?
some very astute commentator. On
yes,
your political opinions, I think.
Someone who's definitely got their ear to the ground when it comes to the two of us. Hello, welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. Jimmy called me a basic bitch with predictable opinions in a private chat, and I thought I'd make it public.
I think I called you that on Twitter, didn't I? Was that Facebook?
No, it was in a Facebook chat. Otherwise, I guess that it's still fair game on Twitter then.
I'm more than happy to go on the record to say that you are a basic bitch with predictable opinions. I can't actually say it properly.
Excellent. Well, you typed it very efficiently.
Yes. Yeah. So what are we going to discuss, Jazza, with you with your basic opinions and me with my far superior ones?
Well, today is Monday the 10th of June, and we have just had the final list of 10... members of Parliament who are vying to be the next leader of the Conservative Party and perhaps Prime Minister. I say perhaps Prime Minister because there's something maybe I'll some processes I'll talk to you about later. But something that we want to kind of specifically address is the apparent rampant drug use of all of these members of Parliament. The majority of those standing have admitted to taking some kind of illegal drug, be it cannabis, opium, or cocaine. And I wanted to talk about the blatant hypocrisy of somebody admitting that they have had cannabis, smoked cannabis or snorted cocaine, or otherwise have avoided all of the possible legal repercussions of doing so, and then insist on continuing to say that it should be an illegal act that people get jailed for.
Well, you know, all of these people who took drugs did not enjoy the experience, and therefore they're just seeking to ensure that nobody else has that terrible fate befall them, Jazza.
Yes,
of
course.
Generosity in by another form.
Obviously. And as we know, Boris Johnson, although he admitted that he was given some cocaine, he probably didn't even inhale any.
Yeah, he sort of rode back on his alleged coke snorting, I suppose we should say. But I'm very prepared to believe that an Etonian who went to Oxford took some cocaine at some point. I think that's plausible, even verging on more likely than not, let's say.
Shock, horror. Imagine if that were true. Secondly, we're going to be talking about... we're back to Birmingham, where the gays are trying to corrupt the children again. Good God. This story is still going on. We've talked about it in the past. There have been protests around a number of Birmingham schools against the introduction of LGBT relationship education to kids at the ages of like 4, 5, and 6. A local MP from Birmingham, Roger Godsiff, who's with the Labour Party, has expressed his sympathies for them. And Jimmy and I talked about this on Twitter. Can you remind the dear listeners who perhaps don't have notifications turned on for us what you said?
What did I say? she prompted me more thoroughly. Basically, there was this Sky story that said that Roger Godsliff had been, quote, reminded of his responsibilities as an MP in supporting these homophobic protests. And all I said was that it is the role of an MP to represent the views of their constituents. I'm paraphrasing slightly. And therefore, I don't think he was not fulfilling his responsibilities as an MP. I mean, there's many other ways in which you could criticise his actions, but I thought that one in particular was illegitimate.
I am not sure that that is actually the role of the MP, and I think we may have talked about this before. You're a delegate. You're not a representative.
It depends on your school of thought, really. It's not really very well defined in the British system.
What a surprise. The British system isn't well defined.
Anyway,
finally, we have, as well as the Conservative leadership election, oh God, we're really obsessed with leadership elections on this podcast, aren't we? But oh well. Vince Cable is stepping down as the leader of the Lib Dems, and if we don't talk about it, nobody will.
To be fair, The Guardian has done a long form or longish interview with Mr. Cable.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what prompted this, because he's handing it over to either Ed Davey or Joe Swinson, as they're the only two people, two Lib Dem MPs, who've actually entered the race to
probably Joe Swinson.
Is there polling that backs that up, or is this just a hunch, one of your infamous hunches?
Why not both?
Why not? Okay, we've kept this short and sweet so we can discuss the Tory drug problem at great length. So should we play some music and then get to the main bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you say short and sweet. We've been speaking for over 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Cool, excellent. Nice to know that's short and sweet for us. Christ.
All right, let's go. If you've made it this far through the podcast, I'm assuming you at least somewhat enjoy what we do, and if you'd like to support us financially, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. It doesn't cost a great deal of money to keep this thing going, but we do need money for hosting and that sort of thing. Our current patrons include David Warner, Emerson Sparts, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt, Michael Costa and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for anyone who's currently supporting us and anyone who has done so previously. If you'd like to join them, go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. Jazza, if you were choosing a prime minister to run this country, what would be your preferred drug of choice for them? What drug would you want them to partake in on a regular basis in order to govern this country effectively?
I mean cannabis, or probably not cannabis, but any kind of CBD, you know? I've just come back from California, calling cannabis CBD is all the rage, and you can now tailor your cannabinoid high to whatever kind of feeling you want. So there was, I went into a shop, obviously I didn't inhale, and there was a load of, like, all of the different types of CBD were named after the feeling that you get from them. One of them was called buzzed, one of them was called aroused, one of them was called mellow. So maybe somebody who was onto the mellow CBD, because I'd quite like them to just chill out for a bit.
You could definitely see the advantages of, you know, any sort of leader who occasionally does cannabis, I think. You know, just to mellow them out a bit, de-stress.
It's very good. It's very good for mindfulness, and I think that's a quality that I would really like to have in a future leader, perhaps. Yeah. I'm waiting for the overtly pro cannabis candidate that eventually rocks up on the political stage, because we're quite far behind a lot of our more liberal allies when it comes to drug legalization.
Well, we're behind certain states in the US and we're behind Canada in general, is that right?
Yes, yeah.
And obviously the Netherlands is everyone's favourite drug-addled country in Europe. don't know where I'll go with that. So this is the story that I think it was initially sparked by Rory Stewart's admission that he'd smoked opium out of politeness. When he
yes.
was at an Iranian wedding.
Can you imagine taking, like, what the hardest drug? Like everybody knows it's the worst drug. Can you imagine taking that just to be polite?
I imagine that if you smoke opium, it has less violent effect on you than, say, mainlining heroin, which is obviously roughly the same drug, but...
Yeah, sure, but it did paralyse the whole country of China for like 200 years.
I'm not saying it's great. I just think, you know, doing it once at a wedding is, you know, it's probably not as bad as it might be. I mean, it's not crack cocaine.
Jimmy Nichols' hot take, it's not that bad.
It's probably fine. I mean, you know, we've all been there. You know, somebody's offering you an illegal substance, you don't want to seem like a square, so you just take it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then feel paranoid for the rest of the evening.
Mm-hmm. So it was the Rory Stewart kind of like eccentricity of, first of all, being in the situation of being in Afghanistan for a wedding, and two, being too polite and too British to say no to taking heroin. And that kind of sparked off a lot of questions about drug use around a lot of the other candidates. Now, we already know that Boris Johnson has taken cocaine. He initially talked about it on Have I Got News For You in 2005, where he did genuinely say, oh, I was given it once, but I sneezed, and so it didn't go up my nose. In fact, it may have been icing sugar. Sure. All right, Boris. Mm. But then later actually admitted to taking it. Jeremy Hunt, in probably the most middle-class gap year encounter with drugs that one could possibly have, had a cannabis lassie when he was backpacking through India. Good God.
What's a cannabis lassie when it's at home?
It's a drink.
Ah.
So you pound it into like a type of drink.
So it's a sort of tea, is it? Is that roughly the idea?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Andrea Leadsom said that she smoked cannabis at university, heaven forbid. Dominic Raab said that he has taken cannabis as a student. Matt Hancock said that he has tried cannabis a few times. And I think that... Oh, and of course there's Govey, who's a cokehead.
Was a cokehead briefly for several months and deeply regretted it in his own
phrase. Yeah,
of
course he did. Yes, of course he did.
I mean, everyone's pretty much already pointed out the hypocrisy. I mean, you even did at the start of this podcast of politicians who have taken illegal substances but seem to have no plans to decriminalise them. Do you have anything to add to that, or is the hypocrisy just so obvious that we don't need to dwell on it for any longer?
The hypocrisy really... It irks me the wrong way. It really pisses me off because, of course, these are the types of people, and I mean mainly middle-class white people, I mean even some upper-class white people, who have never had to feel the bite of the law when it comes to anti-drug law enforcement. They're not part of communities that are ever targeted by these policies, and it's of course the Conservative Party are often those that back the most hard and the most kind of like hardline anti-drug policies when it comes to like the war on drugs and things like that, and they've never had to bear the consequences of what other communities have had to experience. Whether you are poor, or whether you are in the inner city, or whether you're a person of colour and you're actively targeted when it comes to drug enforcement, those are people that end up in prison. People end up in prison because they have a certain amount of cannabis on them. And that boils my blood, because they're people who have broken laws that they continue to break laws that they continue to back, without even thinking that, oh, maybe because I broke the law, then it would be sensible to have this as something that was decriminalised. But anyway,
well, I remember we spoke a little while back about the MP whose son was caught dealing, I think, at a music festival of some sort.
Yes, yeah.
I'm just rapidly trying to like Google this story. I can't remember the name of the MP, but because she'd also employed her son in connection with her role as a politician, there were sort of questions over her judgment. And obviously, if you're making the law, you have to follow it to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, probably fully follow it, really. If you're a lawmaker, you can't also be a lawbreaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, unless these politicians are actually standing on a platform to adjust these drug laws in some way, doesn't this kind of render them all unfit for office, basically?
Yes.
Okay, but one of them is going to end up as Prime Minister, probably.
Yeah, probably. I will say, I think that Rory Stewart's one is probably slightly different. I think probably Jeremy Hunt's one is slightly different. Like just those anecdotes, we don't know what else they may have tried in their meandering lives.
Well, also, apart from anything else, they were abroad, so they weren't actually breaking any British laws.
Yeah, exactly. They weren't breaking any British laws. They were only breaking foreign laws, so I guess that's fine. But you... like, the very common story of people going to university and trying cannabis, or being in a particular profession, like journalism, like Johnson and Gove, and taking cocaine, where, like, that drug is known to be prevalent. You can speak for yourself, Jimmy.
I haven't come across it in journalism, but I do know a fair few people who've done cocaine, not within journalism, but... I don't think it's that uncommon among a certain type of middle-class professional, shall we say.
No, yeah. Like, it depends on the groups that you're surrounded by. But the fact that the fact that it gets brushed off, and the fact that actually Michael Gove's, for whatever reason, his, like, really frank admission that he used it not just once and didn't just, like, sneeze it out and didn't actually take the bloody drug, he was just around it. Like, good on him for actually admitting it.
Well, I think some context to that. The journalist Owen Bennett is going to publish a biography of Michael Gove, and my understanding is that the reason Michael Gove admitted to it so publicly is because it was going to be published.
He's a coward as well. Great.
I think it was in relation to that. That's what I read on Twitter anyway. So yeah, I don't think he would have necessarily... it was the Daily Mail, which is serialising bits of Owen Bennett's biography of Michael Gove. I don't think he would have admitted this if he'd had the option not to, put it that way.
Why do you think that it seems to be that Gove suffered more from this than, say, Boris Johnson, who has similarly had a brush with cocaine? People seem to have been pretty blasé about the Rory Stewart example and the taking of cannabis. Why do you think Gove has kind of is now damaged goods because of these admissions?
Well, I think that the Rory Stewart example, you've already gone through the reasons, and there's something quite eccentric and almost lovable about somebody having taken opium out of politeness. Also Rory Stewart isn't that serious a contender, although I think he's changed. He's had an impact on the race, but I still don't think he'll actually become the leader of the Tory party. Cannabis is, at least from my observations, you can walk around loads of areas of South London and just smell people smoking cannabis pretty openly. It's not that rigorously enforced, and I think it's actually pretty hard to go through life without at some point being offered cannabis. You know, that might be, you know, obviously that does reflect the circles that I operate in, but it's a pretty common drug. And I don't think it's that.
Yeah, you smell it on the streets of London, you smell it all the time. Yeah. In any big city, you smell it all the time.
It's not the police are not hyper vigilant with how they enforce rules around cannabis, and I mean, this is sort of folktale, but I think if they find you and you've only got a personal amount on you, they'll just take it off you and send you on your way.
Yeah, really. Exactly. You won't be charged. Whereas if it's over, I can't remember the exact amount, but if it's over a certain amount where it could be possible that you're dealing, and apparently it's a really small amount actually, an extent where. If you had that amount, then you probably aren't dealing, to be completely honest. You could just be carrying your own personal kind of like carrying it for your personal usage. Then you can be charged, and that's what the majority of cannabis and drug dealing based people in prison are incarcerated for, is for possession with the intent to deal or something along those lines. Is the name of the
Yeah, the rules are very different from if you're found with a recreational amount versus a commercial amount, if you want to put it that way. But coke is a pretty serious drug, actually. I'm pretty sure coke is still classified as a Class A drug.
It is,
And there was this thing that came up actually, that because Michael Gove has been to the US since he took cocaine. When you apply for a US ESTA, which is their visa waiver program, you have to answer questions about your drug use and say, you know, have you ever done anything illegal involving drugs? And he would have had to answer no to that in order to get into the country, but he obviously lied. Then again, I imagine most people.
Well, the same with Boris Johnson. The same with Boris Johnson, but he is an American citizen, though.
He was. He actually renounced his citizenship for tax reasons a while back.
Great.
Because American citizens have to pay income tax when they're working abroad for reasons. Anyway, yeah, I think it's sort of justified because of the severity of the drug that Gove is getting more of a kicking over this, and it also has to be said that he is more of a serious contender than most of the other people at the moment. I think, you know, particularly when you compare, like, Jeremy Hunt, who just took that cannabis, you know, drank that cannabis tea, or Esther McVeigh, Andrea Leadsom, who just had a joint at university or whatever you said it was.
But what about, but why is does Boris seem to still be... Like, he seems like he has momentum. A lot of it is behind closed doors at the moment because the public, frankly, and even the Conservative membership, do not matter in this race at the moment, where they just have to kind of woo the Conservative members of Parliament. But why do you think that Gove has been affected so much more than Johnson?
I think it's probably because Gove actually has an image as a bit of a square. Whereas nobody expects Boris Johnson to behave well. There was that the Donald Trump line that he could, you know, shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't really affect how people felt about him, which I think is true. I think you could say to Boris Johnson, you could find him with his, dick in a cow somewhere. You know,
oh, lovely.
Totally his tits on acid, and no one would be like that surprised. That maybe sounds a little bit extreme. Do you know what I mean? Like, people
dick
just
and a
have
pig.
Our expectations.
We'd allow dick and a pig. Dick and a pig dick is fine. Pig. Dick and a cow is probably a little bit too far.
I mean, that was the weird thing about that David Cameron story that I suppose we're referencing, is that actually when the story came out that David Cameron allegedly put his dick in the sort of... a dead pig's head as like a Bullingdon Club joke or whatever.
Very funny,
still,
that joke.
It's still unverified, but people weren't actually that surprised, I don't think. They were
no,
like,
posh people get up to all sorts of stuff at university and school. They're very odd people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure they're odder than most people, but they can be more expensive with their eccentricities, so maybe that's what that is.
What do you think will be any repercussions to this, apart from for some reason Michael Gove being affected more severely than anybody else?
I think it's probably still Boris Johnson's race to lose. He seems to have the most backing of the... he seems to have enough backing from Tory MPs to get into the final two, which is the point at which it stops being based on what Conservative MPs vote for, and the point at which it starts being about what normal Tory party members want to choose. If he makes it to that stage, the widespread, you know, the conventional wisdom is that he'll win. So he only has to get to those last two. And I think he's got enough momentum behind him. But for Michael Gove, I think it could affect his chances of actually getting through to the last two. I think it's made it more likely that he won't make it. And I guess that, you know, this is sort of a slight stereotype about Tory party members, but I think that enough of them are prudish enough that they might think less of Michael Gove for having done coke, and that might affect whether they want to vote for him or not. Obviously, you have to set that against Boris Johnson.
I guess we also assume that the Conservative membership are reasonably quite straight-laced. I think we just assume that. There's so little information and polling on the Conservative Party, but we just have an idea of who they are, don't we?
Well, we know they're old, I guess. And we know they're disproportionately white, as you brought up last time. Are they disproportionately rural? Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, probably English.
We know they're conservative, I guess. I think they're actually more conservative than the Tory... you know, than Tory MPs on average.
Small C conservative.
Yeah, small C conservative. They're less, you know, I think within their ranks you have fewer liberals, basically, who aren't, you know, free markets and free minds or whatever. Some of whom do actually want to relax the rules around drug enforcement. So yeah, in that sense, it might have an effect. But you might actually find that this weekend, where all of the drug stuff came out, ultimately didn't really matter because Boris was probably going to win anyway, and I think he probably still is going to win at this stage. But you know, stuff might happen. Who knows?
I still don't think so. I know I made one of my Dominic Raab, one of my predictions, and said Dominic Raab. I'm now kind of between him and Jeremy Hunt. I'm not sure, but we'll see. Yeah. So the official final list of 10 MPs was released today, and they're expecting to be down to the final two by next Tuesday, which would be the 18th of June. And then it goes out. There will be, hopefully, I mean, we assume that there will be end up being hustings between the final two, which may or may not include Boris Johnson. Sam Giemer dropped out, so he is no longer running in the race. He was the only person running and offering a second referendum. That's no surprise, right?
I don't think he stood any chance. I mean, even if he'd got to the final two, I just don't think that would have washed with the Tory membership. Mm-hmm. I assume he was doing it to raise his profile and also to change the debate somewhat, and I think he largely failed to do that. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
fair enough,
bless
I guess.
Him. So I was listening to the Talking Politics podcast, which has Dan Runciman and...
David Runciman.
David Runciman, goodness, and I can't remember the name of the lady either, so...
Helen something, isn't it?
Helen from Talking Politics. She... These are two people who are much cleverer than we are and know parliamentary process a lot better than we are. But she was suggesting that it may be possible that one of these individuals will become the leader of the Conservative Party, but then won't be able to become Prime Minister because they won't be able to get the confidence of the Queen in forming a government. They won't be able to form a government because of the lack of, especially if Boris Johnson becomes the leader of the Conservative Party. There are a lot of Conservative MPs who've said that they would no longer take the Conservative whip in that case.
And in that case, you potentially have a situation that leads to a general election or mm-hmm. just leads to a hung parliament where nobody can govern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But if the person cannot form a government, then it has to go to a general election. The Queen dissolves Parliament, and it has to be there has to be another general election.
Well, if you can't form a government, there's a 14-day period in which anyone else can have the opportunity, assuming they can get
yes,
the majority
yes,
in the
of
House
course.
Of Commons.
But if
the
you
opportunity
don't get that
to form a government,
yeah, and you think that Jeremy Corbyn's going to be able to form one, jog on.
If he had, hang on, I'm just trying to think of the numbers here. I mean, there isn't really another viable coalition, is there at all? Even if like the SNP and all of the other sort of small left-wing parties banded together with Jeremy Corbyn, it still wouldn't be a go, would it?
Nope.
No.
I reckon we're going to have a lot of elections this year, Jimmy.
So you're thinking, I mean, you're still predicting Dominic Raab. Do you think that Raab or Hunt would be able to form a government, possibly in alliance with the DUP?
I think the only one who's going to be allowed to form a government and is going to be able to form a government is going to be Hunt.
Because he's not as radical as Dominic Raab.
Yeah, because he doesn't want a no deal, and that's going to get the backing of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland.
I mean, Michael Gove actually said something that I think is interesting in the context of the Brexit debate, in that he's willing to put off Brexit as long as necessary in order to
get
some sort of Brexit deal through.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
I think it's actually pretty sensible. If I were a Brexiteer, that would be what I would be gunning for. I would be playing the long game and be like, I want to make sure that when we do this, we get it right. And sometimes that may require more time. It does depend on how much more time the EU wants to give us, though.
I mean, I think it also depends on what the reaction of the European Research Group and, you know, any other hardliners is to that sort of course of action. But yeah, in some ways it is a sensible approach, but I'm not sure if it's politically practical at the moment for the reasons we just said.
Yep, I probably agree.
So there we are, from one slightly depressing conclusion to another. Jazzy, do you want to explain the backstory to what's been going on in Birmingham?
So we have the rollout of LGBT inclusive relationship education happening across the country, where kids in primary school around the age of 4, 5, 6 are first introduced to relationship education. So it's stuff like it introduces ideas of consent, it introduces ideas of love, of family, and it was just being rolled out that it would introduce the idea that there could be same-sex couples as well as heterosexual couples. Talking about there being somebody having two daddies or two mummies rather than just a mummy and a daddy, essentially putting it just like that. This has outraged the conservative Muslim community in Birmingham, and there's been some quite horrible protests and threats against staff and teachers who want to continue to teach this education. Those protesting this new type of new form of kind of like relationship education for kids have said that they don't want their kids to be exposed at such a young age to the horrors of homosexuality. And they there's kind of like been this, like, generally the liberal media, and the media generally is liberal regardless as to what part of the political spectrum it is, socially liberal, I mean, when it comes to gay rights at the very least.
I think on this particular issue you could say that. I think you could, there's areas of LGBT rights that isn't the case, but I think it is true about about this issue anyway. There's been a bit of a backlash from the media itself.
Yeah, the male is probably going to back the gay couple that's been beaten up on the bus, but they're probably not going to back the people who want there to be trans-inclusive education, because, ooh, trans people. The MP for Birmingham Hall, Birmingham Hall Green, Roger Godsiff, has been reported as saying that he said that, what was it he said? I can't find it.
He called the protests a just cause, quote unquote.
And if you see a photo of him, he looks like the type of person who would say that protesting against same-sex relationship education would be
Jazza,
a just cause.
Jazza. I mean, we're debating, you know, discrimination and prejudice here. You've just totally written off some guy because he looks like a gammon. Which I think is slightly
unfair.
Well,
you're the one. You're the one who just called him a gammon. I'd never described what he looked like. I left it to the listener. You said that it was justified for an MP to take a line that is counter to that of the wider party, the Labour Party, obviously.
I didn't say that.
Is that defend yourself then, sir?
I think so. This is the Sky report. It says a Labour Party spokesman says Chief Whip Nick Brown will speak to Roger Godsliff and remind him of, quote, his responsibilities as an MP, end quote, in relation to this story and the fact that he backed the protesters rather than the pro-LGBT people. And I think, you know, in the kind of responsibilities of an MP are quite convoluted, and in some ways they're quite divided. You do answer to your party, but you also primarily answer to your constituents. You're elected by your constituents. You're not ultimately elected by your party to sit in Parliament, although obviously the local party has a role in putting you forward as a candidate. I don't think it does contradict his responsibilities as an MP. I don't approve of his stance, and I don't approve of the protests. What the protests are trying to achieve, but you know, there is that that line. You know, there's a lot of awful people in this country, and they deserve representation too. Or something to that effect, right?
You've definitely used that before.
There are, it's not the phrase isn't awful people, but it's something similar to that. But my point is, there are people that disapprove of LGBT inclusive relationship education. I think these people can fairly be called homophobes. You obviously do too. But they still have a right to make their case, and if an MP is sympathetic to that and chooses to champion them, that is consistent with his role. That's all I'm saying. But I still think he's in the wrong, ultimately.
Obviously, he is entitled to have his own views. But I feel like this is maybe somewhere where the Labour Party step in. Like, I don't think those views are conducive to the modern-day Labour Party in 2019. Somebody who's standing on the Labour Party platform shouldn't be... shouldn't be able to stand as a Labour MP and take the Labour whip if he has those kinds of views. It's so against... the Labour Party has done so much for the rights of queer and LGBTQ plus people. Not enough. But it's done so much. I find it very confusing that, frankly, he's still got his job.
I mean, I think you can contrast this with the fact that the Peterborough MP, who was just elected, who is also part of the Labour Party...
she's a bit of an anti-Semite, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she's...
Yeah, but that's consistent with the views of the modern-day Labour Party.
Well, yeah, I just think, this is...
I jest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think her position is that inconsistent with the views of Jeremy Corbyn and his entourage, to be honest with you. But it certainly is inconsistent with the general ethos of the Labour Party. Within a given party, although you have what on paper they're supposed to represent, in reality it's more diverse than that. There's also all sorts of people with questionable views in Parliament. That's kind of inevitable. Do you really want a situation where all MPs are actually expected to absolutely toe the line? I know you disagree with Roger Godsliff on this particular issue, but as a general principle, is that something that you want?
I kind of compare this to someone like Tim Farron. I was a member of the Lib Dems when Tim Farron was leader. Tim Farron had personal views about gay marriage and gay sex that were inconsistent with liberal values, one could argue, because he was a Catholic. But he continued.
No, he was an evangelical. He wasn't a Catholic.
Are they different?
Yes, they are different. Okay. They are quite different.
Great, okay.
Evangelicals are Protestants, apart from anything else.
Are they? Oh, God. It's very confusing, this whole Christianity religious shenanigans. Anyway, he continued to kind of vote along party lines or to not vote against his party when it came to LGBT rights, because he was a member of that party. That was the party that most adhered to his views. Oh, but I don't know, mate. I just think he was
pilloried for that, and he was hung out to dry. I think, even though we still joke about it occasionally, but I think it was quite unfair how Tim Farron was ultimately treated, because he didn't appear to have any interest in actually rolling back LGBT rights, even though he did have a theological objection to it.
Yeah, I agree. All he did was not lie, and he could have just lied, and it would have been fine.
Politicians should lie more. It would be better.
Oh, I'm not sure about that phrase. What do you think about... I just want to mention this because it seems a little bit silly. Godsif said that maybe introducing the fact that men or women can hold hands, which is essentially what the... or be parents, which is essentially what the education stipulates and what the education teaches. They shouldn't be taught it at 4 or 5. They should. We should wait until they're 6 or 7. Do you think that would placate the protesters?
So I do think that the schools are actually in a pretty difficult position here. I think we've discussed this before, but ultimately the schools do have to keep parents on side, and if a majority of the parents are unhappy with the sex ed that's being taught, you can't just bully your way through, I don't think. I don't think that that's good for the kids ultimately, because they'll end up being torn between what the school is trying to do and what the parents want. You know, and I think some sort of compromise is probably the only way out of it, although hopefully in the long run fewer parents will actually object to these sorts of lessons. But, you know, the school has to actually deal with this instance in practical terms. It can't take a high level.
There are worries about the views being more entrenched. There's worries about the views being becoming more and more extreme, and of the of there basically being an impasse, that there's going to be no solution to this, because this is the rolling out of what is going to be a compulsory piece of a compulsory part of the curriculum across the whole country. You're not going to be able to take your kids out of these classes in the same way that people have been able to be taken out of sex education classes. I worry about violence, and I worry about like LGBT families in the area. I worry about teachers who insist on standing by like LGBT members of the school, or members of like the parents and all of that kind of stuff. This thing really worries me, and I worry that it isn't talked about enough. The fact that these have been ongoing for like months now, these protests.
Well, I think that you can't really bulldoze people in that way. But in some instances, you know, there have been debates around civil rights where the police have just ended up intervening in communities that weren't necessarily appreciative of what it was that the federal authorities or the state, you know, the state at large was trying to do. So, you know, it probably has to be taken on a case by case basis. But yeah, I suspect that there is, as is evidenced by this protest, there is serious potential for some backlash in instances like this.
Yeah, agreed. Shall we move on to our favourite?
Our favourite?
Vince Cable. Oh, we love Vince.
Do we love Vince? I'm fairly indifferent to Vince.
Oh, you're indifferent to fucking everything.
So Vince Cable is standing down as Lib Dem leader. Is he standing down before the conference this autumn? Is that
roughly? Yeah.
And he's making way for either Red Davey or Joe Swinson. You think that Joe Swinson's a bit of a shoo-in for the next leader of the Lib Dems.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read the Guardian interview that we mentioned earlier?
Oh, I got about halfway through.
Do you want to
summarise it?
It sounds as though Vince Cable is fairly open to what happens next for the Lib Dems. I mean, it's quite a gushing interview write-up, to be fair. But it does make the point that the Lib Dems did well in the local elections. They did well in the European elections, coming second. And that's because, you know, you'd assume, because they had a very clear stance on Brexit. Mm-hmm. They're the party of Remain.
Mm-hmm.
They also did much better than Change UK, even though Change UK had quite a lot of publicity when they launched earlier this year. And it does seem like Vince Cable is actually fairly open to there being more coordination between the parties, and potentially even a merger at some point, or in the case of Change UK, the now independent MPs joining the Lib Dems. You're more ardently pro Lib Dem than I am nowadays because of the whole Brexit thing. So what did you think reading this interview then?
I think it sounds quite sensible. But I think that it really shows the problem with Vince Cable is that he isn't a man with a huge... He's a quiet and considered man in an age where everybody is shouting. And maybe that was part of his appeal, and maybe that's been part of his appeal. But I feel... Because he became leader unopposed in the same kind of like manner as May. And he was kind of... He's an old statesman, and has been kind of around the Lib Dems. He defected from Labour in the 1980s when they went from the Liberals and the Social Democrats to the Liberal Democrats. And I feel like he's just of a different age. I don't think he's of this time. And I worry a little bit that the likes of Joe Swinson are also kind of like a little... Maybe they're a little bit too considered and quiet and don't have enough of the bite that necessarily is needed to be able to cut through in the modern rhetoric. And I think that you can talk about people wanting there to be a stronger middle ground as much as you like, but I'm not sure that actually ignites people anymore at the moment.
But do you really want a shrieky Remainer leading your campaign?
No, but I think that maybe somebody like Nick Clegg is someone who strikes that balance of, like, the pragmatist. Shut up, leave me alone, I love him.
Still shilling for Clegg.
I love him so much. I want to be him when I grow up. I want a Spanish wife. But he... he was kind of like... He was a little bit of a rock star. And he was gunning for a fight, and would challenge people to debates, and would point out their inconsistencies with vigor, and he had so much energy. And I don't see anybody in the Liberal Democrats with energy at the moment, and I think that's something that putting somebody who is who has been around so long, who has been who is quite old, doesn't necessarily have as much, like, I don't want to be rude, but doesn't necessarily have as much energy anymore as the head of the party that is has the correct answer to the question for the majority of, like, young people when it comes to, like, the membership of the European Union. I don't know. I don't know how how the Lib Dems end up with, like, a better bit of branding. I don't know. Leila Moran is probably the closest person who would be eligible to be the next leader, but who isn't running, who's probably the closest to that kind of, like, young and vigorous kind of, like, go get 'em attitude. What do you think?
I mean, she is willing to knock some sense into people.
Oh my god.
Sorry, I mean, it's just I'm sort of referring there to the fact that she was caught up in a domestic violence instance. It sounds bad when you explain the joke, but it's such a... she essentially slapped her boyfriend.
Yeah, she slapped her boyfriend and was arrested for it because that's illegal in Scotland.
It's such a lame Lib Dem level scandal.
It is! I love it!
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right that they do sort of lack anybody with... It feels wrong to say the rock star factor, because I don't think there are any politicians really with a rock star factor, but, you know, some pizzazz at least that people can actually get behind. But, you know, that said, you know, for even though I agree with you in general, it does appear as though the slow and steady approach of just getting back to local campaigning has actually paid dividends for the Lib Dems.
Yeah,
so
but well, don't you think it's got a lot more to do with the fact that they have a really deep party infrastructure, and they know how to, like, get out their vote, and they know how to capitalize on reduced voter turnout for other places, for other parties and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a part. I think also their very clear stance on Brexit helped them quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to, I mean, you know, Alistair Campbell famously has been kicked out of Labour for voting Lib Dems and then saying so on national television, which breaks Labour Party rules. So, you know, they obviously drew in like some fairly notable people who are associated with the Labour Party who didn't like Jeremy Corbyn's equivocation about Brexit.
Do you think that it's inevitable that Vince Cable, I mean, maybe he is kind of like a behind the scenes guy, but he's seen this huge, like, resurgence of the Liberal Democrats coming second in the European elections and doing really, really well in the local elections this year. Do you think that he's going to be given the credit for that? I feel like he isn't, but maybe he should.
Well, I think some of it is outside factors, but he seems to have been a steady hand on the tiller, as it were, in a time that, you know, there's been a lot of turbulence around the other political parties. I think that's a general problem with just human life, is that people who do subtle things in behind the scenes often get much less credit than people who are showy about it. And I think in general, when people are analysing party leaders, they put a lot more store in their public persona than they do in their behind the scenes work. Partly because you can only really get to the behind the scenes work often years after it's happened, because that at that point people are willing to talk about what happened behind the scenes and it's not so politically contentious to do so. But, you know, I think I'm sure that if you're an otherwise stranded Remain voter that's very upset as to what's happened around Brexit in the last 3 years, then actually the Lib Dems have been quite appealing, and I think Vince Cable does deserve credit for that, whatever else you say about him.
I have a question for you before we perhaps wrap up. Would you, if we were to finally leave the European Union, with a deal or without, would you then perhaps return to the Liberal Democrats, even if they were, their policy was to take us back into the European Union, because it inevitably will be?
I don't think I would, to be honest with you.
Oh no, Jimmy, are you politically homeless?
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think most people are these days, so I don't think that's too bad. I mean, it, you know, it's difficult. This will sound a bit smug, but if you think about, if you're interested in politics and you think about it a lot, it becomes quite difficult to actually find a party that fits your beliefs, because you often end up feeling quite strongly about a lot of different things, and therefore that pulls you between parties in a way that you're not really so divided if you just have like a lukewarm interest in it, and you know, just turn up for elections. I'm sure most of our listeners could actually relate to that.
You're right, that did sound smug.
That's why you're a basic bitch with predictable opinions, Jazza.
Cut me and I bleed yellow.
As we've come full circle. I mean, I actually don't want to quite leave it there.
Yeah.
They'll obviously campaign to re-enter the EU, assuming we actually do leave, which I think is an open question at this point. Mm-hmm. What do you rate the prospects of such a campaign?
Of what campaign? Of us? Of them?
A campaign to rejoin the EU. How successful, how much appetite do you think there'll be if we actually manage to leave?
I've told you this, I'm not a shoo-in. It would completely depend on the terms on which we would re-enter. I think that we currently have the best deal of all of the European Union members. And if we were to go in and not maintain and not retain, or go back to a lot of the same kind of like financial things, I'd have to think about it. Like, obviously, I am... Mm. My identity is pretty... Yeah, like, I identify as European. And I like the EU. But you have to think about the good of the country sometimes. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But they will be campaigning for a return from day one. Definitely.
Yeah, I think they probably will be, and I think that there's a core of people. I probably would have included you in this, but you obviously do feel a bit more ambivalent about it. But there's a so-called group of radicalized Remainers who do feel very passionately European, in a political sense at least, and who are really, really keen that we stay in the EU, or all that we would rejoin if we left. But I think that's a relatively small group of people.
It's when you put the rejoin on the table, no matter what, then you're no better than the hardcore Brexiteers who want us to leave the EU with no deal and want to leave no matter what. I think that that's really irresponsible. I think you have to allow for there to be nuance. You have to allow for the circumstances to perhaps change once we have left. And we don't know what the European Union is going to look like in maybe the 5 to 10 years that it would take for us to rejoin. That's why I'm more kind of measured about it, because we don't know what the European Union would look like if we were to join again. And I'm better than Dominic Raab.
Okay, we'll leave it there. If you want to tweet at us, you can tweet Jazza at JazzaJohn, you can tweet me at JDENichols, or you can tweet the podcast in general at Right Dishonor. You can also find us at rightdishonorable.com, or you can go to Patreon.
Jimmy's writing some very good articles at the moment.
I'm writing some okay articles, some readable articles with colourful imagery.
It's what you do well.
You can go to patreon.com/rightdishonorable if you want to throw us some money, as we have previously said. No one's listening now. We should probably just stop.
if you are listening now, give us a tweet. Watch nobody tweet us. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.